Bethlehem, Palestine. With his rugged looks and polished charm, Saladin Khadr could be a movie star. He is friendly but never obsequious, self-assured but never arrogant. He is a professor of urban planning at Khalil Gibran University, and naturally, the love of all his female students. We sit under the statue of the university's namesake. Like everything else in one of the Middle East's most affluent cities, its polished bronze glitters in the sun. I was born and raised in Kuwait City. My family was one of the few lucky ones not to be expelled after 1991, after Arafat sided with Saddam against the world. We weren't rich, but neither were we struggling. I was comfortable, even sheltered, you might say, and oh, did it show in my actions. I watched the Al Jazeera broadcast from behind the counter at the Starbucks, where I worked every day after school. It was the afternoon rush hour, and the place was packed. You should have heard the uproar, the jeers and catcalls. I'm sure our noise level matched that on the floor of the General Assembly. Of course, we thought it was a Zionist lie. Who didn't? When the Israeli ambassador announced to the UN General Assembly that his country was enacting a policy of voluntary quarantine, what was I supposed to think? Was I supposed to really believe his crazy story that African rabies was actually some new plague that transformed dead bodies into bloodthirsty cannibals? How can you possibly believe that kind of foolishness, especially when it comes from your most hated enemy? I didn't even hear the second part of that fat bastard's speech, the part about offering asylum, no questions asked, to any foreign-born Jew, any foreigner of Israeli-born parents, any Palestinian living in the formerly occupied territories, and any Palestinian whose family had once lived within the borders of Israel. The last part applied to my family, refugees from the 67 War of Zionist Aggression. At the heeding of the PLO leadership, we had fled our village, believing we could return as soon as our Egyptian and Syrian brothers had swept the Jews into the sea. I had never been to Israel, or what was about to be absorbed into the new state of unified Palestine. What did you think was behind the Israeli ruse? Here's what I thought. The Zionists have just been driven out of the occupied territories. They say they left voluntarily, just like Lebanon, and most recently the Gaza Strip. But really, just like before, we knew we'd driven them out. They know that the next and final blow would destroy that illegal atrocity they call a country. And to prepare for that final blow, they're attempting to recruit both foreign Jews as cannon fodder and... I thought I was so clever for figuring this part out. Kidnapping as many Palestinians as they could to act as human shields. I had all the answers. Who doesn't at 17? My father wasn't quite convinced of my ingenious geopolitical insights. He was a janitor at Amiri Hospital. He'd been on duty the night it had its first major African rabies outbreak. He hadn't personally seen the bodies rise from their slabs, or the carnage of panicked patients and security guards, but he'd witnessed enough of the aftermath to convince him that staying in Kuwait was suicidal. He'd made up his mind to leave the same day Israel made their declaration. That must have been difficult to hear. It was blasphemy. I tried to make him see reason, to convince him with my adolescent logic. I'd show the images from Al Jazeera, the images coming out of the new West Bank state of Palestine, the celebrations, the demonstrations. Anyone with eyes could see total liberation was at hand. The Israelis had withdrawn from all the occupied territory and were actually preparing to evacuate Al-Quds, what they called Jerusalem. All the factional fighting, the violence between our various resistance organizations, I knew that would die down once we unified for the final blow against the Jews. Couldn't my father see this? Couldn't he understand that in a few years, a few months, we would be returning to our homeland, this time as liberators, not as refugees. How was your argument resolved? Resolved. What a pleasant euphemism. It was resolved after the second outbreak, the larger one at Al-Jarrah. My father had just quit his job, cleared out our bank account, such as it was. Our bags were packed, our e-tickets confirmed. The TV was blaring in the background, riot police storming the front entrance of a house. You couldn't see what they were shooting at inside. The official report blamed the violence on pro-Western extremists. My father and I were arguing, as always. He tried to convince me of what he'd seen at the hospital, that by the time our leaders acknowledged the danger, it would be too late for any of us. I, of course, scoffed at his timid ignorance, at his willingness to abandon the struggle. What else could I expect from a man who'd spent his whole life scrubbing toilets in a country that treated our people only slightly better than its Filipino guest workers? He'd lost his perspective, his self-respect. The Zionists were offering the hollow promise of a better life, and he was jumping at it like a dog with scraps. My father tried, with all the patience he could muster, to make me see that he had no more love for Israel than the most militant Al-Aqsa martyr. But they seemed to be the only country actively preparing for the coming storm, certainly the only one that would so freely shelter and protect our family. I laughed in his face. Then I dropped the bomb. I told him that I'd already found a website for the children of Yassin, and was waiting for an email from a recruiter supposedly operating right in Kuwait City. Note 1. Children of Yassin, a youth-based terrorist organization named for the late Sheikh Yassin. Under strict recruitment codes, all martyrs could be no older than 18. End note. I told my father to go and be the Yehud's whore if he wanted, but the next time we'd meet was when I would be rescuing him from an internment camp. I was quite proud of those words. I thought they sounded very heroic. I glared in his face, stood from the table, and made my final pronouncement. Surely the vilest of beasts in Allah's sight are those who disbelieve. Note 2. Sure, the vilest of beasts in Allah's sight are those who disbelieve. Then they would not believe. From the Holy Quran, Part 8, Section 55. End note. The dinner table suddenly became very silent. My mother looked down, my sisters looked at each other. All you could hear was the TV, the frantic words of the on-site reporter telling everyone to remain calm. My father was not a large man. By that time, I think I was even bigger than him. He was also not an angry man. I don't think he ever raised his voice. I saw something in his eyes, something I didn't recognize. And then suddenly he was on me, a lightning whirlwind that threw me up against the wall, slapped me so hard my left ear rang. "You will go," he shouted as he grabbed my shoulders and repeatedly slammed me against the cheap drywall. "I am your father. You will obey me." His next slap sent my vision flashing white. "You will leave with this family or you will not leave this room alive." More grabbing and shoving, shouting and slapping. I didn't understand where this man had come from, this lion who'd replaced my docile, frail excuse for a parent. A lion protecting his cubs. He knew that fear was the only weapon he had left to save my life, and if I didn't fear the threat of the plague, then, damn it, I was going to fear him. Did it work? Laughs. Some martyr I turned out to be. I think I cried all the way to Cairo. Cairo? There were no direct flights to Israel from Kuwait, not even from Egypt, once the Arab League imposed its travel restrictions. We had to fly from Kuwait to Cairo, then take a bus across the Sinai Desert to the crossing at Tabah. As we approached the border, I saw the wall for the first time. It was still unfinished, naked steel beams rising above the concrete foundation. I'd known about the infamous security fence, what citizen of the Arab world didn't, but I'd always been led to believe that it only surrounded the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Out here in the middle of this barren desert, it only confirmed my theory that the Israelis were expecting an attack along their entire border. Good, I thought. The Egyptians have finally rediscovered their balls. At Taba, we were taken off the bus and told to walk, single file, past cages that held very large and fierce-looking dogs. We went one at a time. A border guard, this skinny black African, I didn't know there were black Jews, would hold out his hand. Note 3. By this point, the Israeli government had completed Operation Moses II, which transported the last of the Ethiopian Falasha into Israel. End note. "Wait there," he said in barely recognizable Arabic. Then, "You go. Come." The man before me was old. He had a long white beard and supported himself on a cane. As he passed the dogs, they went wild, howling and snarling, biting and charging at the confines of their cages. Instantly, two large chaps in civilian clothing were at the old man's side, speaking something in his ear and escorting him away. I could see the man was injured. His dishdasha was torn at the hip and stained with brown blood. These men were certainly no doctors, however, and the black, unmarked van they escorted him to was certainly no ambulance. Bastards, I thought, as the old man's family wailed after him, weeding out the ones too sick and old to be of any use to them. Then it was our turn to walk the gauntlet of dogs. They didn't bark at me, nor the rest of my family. I think one of them even wagged its tail as my sister held out her hand. The next man after us, however, again came the barks and growls. Again came the nondescript civilians. I turned to look at him and was surprised to see a white man, American maybe, or Canadian. No, he had to be American. His English was too loud. "Come on, I'm fine," he shouted and struggled. "Come on, man, what the fuck?" He was well-dressed, a suit and tie, matching luggage that was tossed aside as he began to fight with the Israelis. "Dude, come on, get the fuck off me. I'm one of you. Come on." The buttons on his shirt ripped open, revealing a blood-stained bandage wrapped tightly around his stomach. He was still kicking and screaming as they dragged him into the back of the van. I didn't understand it. Why these people? Clearly, it wasn't just about being an Arab, or even about being wounded. I saw several refugees with severe injuries pass through without molestation from the guards. They were all escorted to waiting ambulances, real ambulances, not the black vans. I knew it had something to do with the dogs. Were they screening for rabies? That made the most sense to me, and it continued to be my theory during our internment outside Yeroam, the resettlement camp. Resettlement and quarantine. At that time, I just saw it as a prison. It was exactly what I'd expected to happen to us. The tents, the overcrowding, the guards, barbed wire, and the seething, baking Negev desert sun. We felt like prisoners. We were prisoners. And although I would have never had the courage to say to my father, "I told you so," he could see it clearly in my sour face. What I didn't expect was the physical examinations, every day from an army of medical personnel. Blood, skin, hair, saliva, even urine and feces. It was exhausting, mortifying. Note 4. At the time, it was unsure whether the virus could survive in solid waste outside of the human body. End note. The only thing that made it bearable, and probably what prevented an all-out riot among some of the Muslim detainees, was that most of the doctors and nurses doing the examinations were themselves Palestinian. The doctor who examined my mother and sisters was a woman, an American woman, from a place called Jersey City. The man who examined us was from Jabalia in Gaza, and had himself been a detainee only a few months before. He kept telling us, "You made the right decision to come here. You'll see. I know it's hard, but you'll see it was the only way." He told us it was all true, everything the Israelis had said. I still couldn't bring myself to believe him, even though a growing part of me wanted to. We stayed at Yeroam for 3 weeks, until our papers were processed and our medical examinations finally cleared. You know, the whole time, they barely even glanced at our passports. My father had done all this work to make sure our official documents were in order. I don't think they even cared. Unless the Israeli Defense Force or the police wanted you for some previous unkosher activities, all that mattered was your clean bill of health. The Ministry of Social Affairs provided us with vouchers for subsidized housing, free schooling, and a job for my father at a salary that would support the entire family. This is too good to be true, I thought, as we boarded the bus for Tel Aviv. The hammer is going to fall any time now. It did once we entered the city of Beersheba. I was asleep. I didn't hear the shots or see the driver's windscreen shatter. I jerked awake as I felt the bus swerve out of control. We crashed into the side of a building. People screamed. Glass and blood were everywhere. My family was close to the emergency exit. My father kicked the door open and pushed us out into the street. There was shooting from the windows, doorways. I could see that it was soldiers versus civilians, civilians with guns or homemade bombs. This is it, I thought. My heart felt like it was going to burst. This liberation has started. Before I could do anything, run out to join my comrades in battle, someone had me by the shirt and was pulling me through the doorway of a Starbucks. I was thrown on the floor next to my family. My sisters were crying as my mother tried to crawl on top of them. My father had a bullet wound in the shoulder. An IDF soldier shoved me on the ground, keeping my face away from the window. My blood was boiling. I started looking for something I could use as a weapon, maybe a large shard of glass to ram through the Yehud's throat. Suddenly, a door at the back of the Starbucks swung open. The soldier turned in its direction and fired. A bloody corpse hit the floor right beside us. A grenade rolled out of his twitching hand. The soldier grabbed the bomb and tried to hurl it into the street. It exploded in midair. His body shielded us from the blast. He tumbled back over the corpse of my slain Arab brother. Only he wasn't an Arab at all. As my tears dried, I noticed that he wore payas and a yarmulke, and bloody tzitzit snaked out from his damp, shredded trousers. This man was a Jew. The armed rebels out in the street were Jews. The battle raging all around us wasn't an uprising by Palestinian insurgents, but the opening shots of the Israeli Civil War. In your opinion, what do you believe was the cause of that war? I think there were many causes. I know the repatriation of Palestinians was unpopular. So was the general pullout from the West Bank. I'm sure the Strategic Hamlet Resettlement Program must have inflamed more than its share of hearts. A lot of Israelis had to watch their houses bulldozed in order to make way for those fortified, self-sufficient residential compounds. Al-Quds, I believe. That was the final straw. The coalition government decided that it was the one major weak point, too large to control, and a hole that led right into the heart of Israel. They not only evacuated the city, but the entire Nablus to Hebron corridor as well. They believed that rebuilding a shorter wall along the 1967 demarcation line was the only way to ensure physical security, no matter what backlash might occur from their own religious right. I learned all this much later, you understand, as well as the fact that the only reason the IDF eventually triumphed was because the majority of the rebels came from the ranks of the ultra-Orthodox, and therefore most had never served in the armed forces. Did you know that? I didn't. I realized I practically didn't know anything about these people I'd hated my entire life. Everything I thought was true went up in smoke that day, supplanted by the face of our real enemy. I was running with my family into the back of an Israeli tank when one of those unmarked vans came around the corner. Note 5. Unlike most countries' main battle tanks, the Israeli Merkava contains rear hatches for troop deployment. End note. A handheld rocket slammed right into its engine. The van catapulted into the air, crashed upside down, and exploded into a brilliant orange fireball. I still had a few steps to go before reaching the doors of the tank, just enough time to see the whole event unfold. Figures were climbing out of the burning wreckage, slow-moving torches, whose clothes and skin were covered in burning petrol. The soldiers around us began firing at the figures. I could see little pops in their chests where the bullets were passing harmlessly through. The squad leader next to me shouted, "Barosh! Yora Barosh!" And the soldiers adjusted their aim. The figures, the creatures, heads exploded. The petrol was just burning out as they hit the ground, these charred, black, headless corpses. Suddenly I understood what my father had been trying to warn me about, what the Israelis had been trying to warn the rest of the world about. What I couldn't understand was why the rest of the world wasn't listening.